we've learned anything from these past couple of years, my fellow Americans, it's that personal medical freedom and liberty are in crisis. America Out Loud Pulse brings together the top experts in healthcare-related fields to keep you a beat ahead.
Welcome, everyone. This is Dr. James Lyons Weiler. I am your host today on The Pulse. We have a very important guest today, my first guest on America Out Loud. We're going to be talking about a new scientific study that finds evidence of hyperbaric oxygen therapy efficacy for patients with mild traumatic brain injury. Approximately 1.5 million people suffer from traumatic brain injury in the United States every year. Only about 230K survive to be hospitalized and survive with varying degrees of health outcomes. Perhaps you know someone who has suffered from traumatic brain injury. And so it is very stressful, obviously, to have a loved one with traumatic brain injury who can no longer do things that they used to be able to do. And of course, we want people to recover as quickly and as completely as possible. Well, there's this syndrome that I've just recently learned about called persistent post-concussion syndrome. And I learned about it from a study that was a review of multiple randomized controlled trials. This review found hyperbaric oxygen therapy at 1.5 atmospheric pressure to provide improvements in symptoms and cognition for patients with mild traumatic brain injury. My guest today is Dr. Paul Harsh. He is the clinical professor of medicine at the LSU School of Medicine in New Orleans. Welcome to The Pulse, Dr. Harsh.
Thank you very much. An honor and pleasure to be on with you.
Right. Thank you. So our listeners might not be familiar with HBOT. So in a minute or two, would you break down the history of hyperbaric oxygen therapy? Who had the first idea to put someone under pressure with high oxygen? Where did that come from?
It was a clergyman in 1662 in England named Henshaw. And he constructed a kind of bellows-driven apparatus that was an enclosed vessel. And that was the first hyperbaric chamber. And he began treating people, and the idea was that higher pressures might be able to treat acute illnesses, and lower pressures might be good for chronic illnesses. And it eventually spread, and by the 1800s, there were large walk-in hyperbaric chambers throughout most of the big cities in Europe. And then peculiarly, it died out. And part of what happened is people discovered decompression sickness, and the hyperbaric chambers at that time were known as hyperbaric baths, where people would go in and, quote, soak for hours at a time. And there's always been a curious phenomenon in hyperbaric medicine. If some pressure and oxygen worked, more was better. And what they started doing was treating people fairly deep. Well, the limits for decompression sickness, the limits for a hyperbaric treatment, or the equivalent scuba dive, is about 60 minutes at 60 feet of pressure. Beyond that, you have to do decompression stops, or you end up with decompression illness. And the other thing that happened is oxygen was discovered in the 1860s, and oxygen toxicity then became a potential issue. But the long story short was it died out, and then resurged and made a resurgence in the United States during the Spanish flu pandemic in the US. And an anesthesiologist in Kansas City discovered that just increased pressurized air had a beneficial effect on dying Spanish flu patients. And pretty soon he was salvaging Spanish flu patients by the dozens. And it had another resurgence, but again died out by about the time of World War II. And finally, in the late 50s, with the use in diving by the U.S. Navy, and then some experiments in clinical use in the Netherlands for anaerobic conditions, let's call them, the flesh-eating bacteria, for instance, gas gangrene, and so on. It made its final debut, if you will. And for the past 60 years, It's been used worldwide, but for, at least in the United States, a limited number of diagnoses, and with pure oxygen. Prior to the 1950s, it was all pressurized air. And that's the history.
Okay, well, thank you so much. You know, as you know, you and I were introduced by Dr. Ted Fogarty, and he is a very good mentor in this area for me in hyperbaric oxygen therapy. The procedure is FDA approved, but there are some off-label procedures for which it obviously the physicians, the board certified physicians that use this medicine in the medical procedure have discovered some off-label uses. Can you discuss briefly a little bit of the controversy that had recent a couple of years ago till today, where we have on-label uses of hyperbaric oxygen therapy that the FDA approves of, and yet for off-label, FDA likes to kind of rattle their sabers about that.
Right. Well, the practice of medicine has traditionally been, according to the Hippocratic Oath, I will find regimen and prescribe regimen for my patient, regimen meaning diet, exercise, therapy, whatever. The Hippocratic practice of medicine, however, changed to the FDA practice of medicine with the FDA Act. And the FDA then had to, or did, approve for marketing every new drug and device in the United States. Well, once anything is approved by the FDA for marketing by the manufacturer, any doctor can use it however they want. So it's still the practice of medicine according to the Hippocratic Oath, but we have applied this off-label term to it to almost designate that something not cleared by the FDA for marketing specifically is a less than acceptable practice of medicine. In fact, it's not. And so if we look at the United States, the FDA clearance came in the late 1970s for hyperbaric chambers, retroactively. They were introduced in the 1960s to the US. And the FDA cleared the chambers for marketing for a narrow list of 13 indications. But in Russia, they use it for 70 diagnoses, China 49, Japan 33, et cetera. So we have been saddled, if you will, with this kind of narrow list. However, it is a treatment for essentially wounding conditions and wounds anywhere in the body. And there has just been a natural extension to applying this increased pressure and increased oxygen to a very wide range of medical conditions. And that's what our discussion today is about with traumatic brain injury.
Yeah, absolutely. So, given the fact that the mechanism of action is the same, although the exact clinical diagnosis or the nature of the conditions that might be treatable by HPOP may differ from the diagnostic standpoint, with the advent of molecular medicine and our understanding what's actually happening, the wound healing response, the initiation. I mean, let's just back up briefly for 1 second. I want to remind everyone that what happens with high oxygen and pressure, you can get human tissue to 100% saturation of oxygen in a hyperbaric chamber, which is a fantastic thing to do if, say, if someone has seared their lungs so to the point where they can't absorb oxygen long enough, well enough. But in the time that we have left here, we have 6 or 7 minutes left. Would you please describe your review and the studies behind it and what you found? And there's a nuanced point that the scientific evidence actually shows that might not be appreciated even by some physicians who practice hyperbaric oxygen therapy about the degree of treatment. So go ahead, let's hear about this review.
Well, what I did was summarize all of the studies that have been done on people who have had persistent symptoms from what is termed mild traumatic brain injury. So mild traumatic brain injury means any alteration in level of consciousness up to 30 minutes of loss of consciousness. And if we look at your figures, I'm going to upgrade just a little bit. The estimate is well over now 4.5 million people per year in the U.S. alone that experience a mild traumatic brain injury. There's another who maybe 10% or so that experience more severe forms. But that mild traumatic brain injury, anywhere from 15 to 44% of them end up with permanent symptoms that are extremely disabling. And what has happened is there are a series of studies begun with the first one that I had done with a case report in a veteran and subsequently others that showed that a variety of different oxygen and air pressures could have beneficial effects on improving what was always termed a psychiatric condition. In fact, it's an organic injury to the brain. And with a series of treatments, this condition is considered permanent if you've got these residual symptoms 3 months or longer. What we took was, and what this review showed, is people with symptoms for years were able to show improvements in their symptoms and cognition that were startling. So the article sums up all of these publications, and what is found is it meets the highest level of evidence in medicine and is a grade A practice recommendation, meaning it should be delivered to patients with this condition unless, quote, there's a compelling reason not to treat, unquote. And that's the substance of the article. And it's based on the science of this therapy and what it is doing for each patient.
Excellent. So in the frontiers of neurology, this review also points out that there's a narrow amount of dosage, it would be pressure, where there was higher efficacy. Could you just review that for us?
Yes. Well, just a quick review. Hyperbaric oxygen, as it turns out, is a dual component drug. It's composed of increased pressure and increased oxygen. And what was found is there were a variety of different doses that were used in these studies, from compressed air to pure oxygen. And what was found, which was kind of startling, we have not been in the habit. Everybody thinks that hyperbaric oxygen has to be 100% oxygen at increased pressure. In fact, it doesn't need to be. And what was found was that a narrow range of just increased atmospheric pressure was the more determinant factor than the amount of oxygen. And so in a narrow range of pressure between about 1.3 and 1.5 atmospheres of pressure, which is the equivalent of about 10 feet of seawater to 16 and a half feet of seawater pressure. In other words, a scuba dive that's a little deeper than a swimming pool, that amount of pressure and its incipient oxygen was enough to permanently change or have a profound impact on people's brain injuries.
That makes a great deal of sense, since the oxygen itself can be damaging to tissue if there are free radicals around, and we could have interactions between some problem going on with the tissue that we really don't want to have too much oxygen around for. So I think that makes sense. Dose makes the poison applies in this condition. So just in a couple of minutes that we have left here, I want to celebrate the lives that you've impacted, the people's lives who you've improved through your research and through your medical practice, and all physicians that have adopted hyperbaric oxygen therapy as part of their regimen for clinical practice. Everything from drowning victims, who obviously need a return to oxygen fairly quickly, to COVID patients. And I just wanted to give a very brief, we have only a couple of minutes left, a brief overview of the observations made, the real world data on the potential utility of HBOT for some of the more recent clinical problems that we see in the world.
Okay, well, that's a great point. This is a generic treatment, meaning it is treating underlying disease pathophysiology, the disease processes. And as a result, it turns out it can be applied to many, many, many different conditions. And we investigated this for at least neurological conditions for a full decade in the 1990s. And what we found is that we could treat a large variety of conditions, and the effects, especially for neurological ones, there are no treatments for the vast majority of neurological conditions. And this impacts many of them. And that's what you're referring to in publications and others now worldwide that are duplicating this and showing the same thing. In fact, the effect is sometimes so startling that there's a term that patients continue to express to us, and that is, thank you for giving me back my life. And that's exactly what this therapy has done. From Alzheimer's patients to drowned children, now 110 of them I've treated, to people with traumatic brain injury, stroke, autism, a really long list of different diagnoses. Another thing I forgot to mention, and really the beauty of this article, is that it now meets the standard for reimbursement of a therapy by insurance companies. Insurance companies want to see randomized trials, and this study summarizes multiple randomized trials, in fact, six of them, such that the evidence now can pass review committees for insurance companies, and patients should be at last able to get this therapy reimbursed for persistent post-concussion syndrome.
That's brilliant and beautiful. Thank you. Well, listen, people, it's systematic review and dosage analysis, hyperbaric oxygen therapy, efficacy and mild traumatic brain injury, persistent post-concussion syndrome, a systematic review in Frontiers of Neurology, published the 17th of March, 2022. This article has thousands of views, thousands and thousands. Please share it and spread it, the good news. Thank you very much, Dr. Harsh.
My pleasure. Thank you.
In today's world, there's no escaping the headlines filled with warnings about emerging viruses and dangerous superbugs. Genesis is the only technology that safely and effectively obliterates harmful pathogens both on the air and on surfaces. Genesis plus HOCL neutralize these threats to your environment in just seconds. Find out more about this amazing technology at genesisfogger.com/outloud for a 15% discount. With Genesis, you'll be prepared for what's next.
Trouble getting to sleep and staying asleep can be infuriating. Your mind races. You toss and turn, and the harder you try, the harder it is to drift off. And today's digital age makes it even harder. You're not alone with this struggle. Poor sleep affects over 70% of Americans. Even the Centers for Disease Control label insufficient sleep a public health epidemic. To take back your sleep, Healthy Cell has created REM Sleep, the only sleep supplement made to support all four stages of human sleep with calming herbs, amino acids, and sleep hormone support, delivered in a patent-pending, pill-free, ultra-absorption microgel formula that tastes great. Fall asleep, stay asleep, sleep deeply, and wake up refreshed with Healthy Cell's REM Sleep. Go to HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off your first order. That's HealthyCell.com, HealthyCell, and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
All right, our next segment, we're going to be discussing an initiative that's underway right now in response to evidence that the FDA is making moves with COVID vaccine on our children. And in this segment of the program, I have two wonderfully close friends, two health freedom informed consent activists, who are going to inform you right from the beginning on details all the way down to the bottom about what's going on with the FDA making moves to get COVID-19 vaccines into very young children. It's my pleasure to introduce to you, if you don't know them, Susie Olson Corgan and Kevin Jenkins. How are you two doing today?
Well, thank you, Jack.
Okay, thank you, Jack. Great. Thank you. So listen, the initiative is hashtag parents are watching and hashtag protect the kids, the primary being parents are watching. Hashtag parents are watching. Susie, why don't you tell me why the American Health and Freedom Coalition, which is a loosely structured, informal coalition of parents and organizations, put together the hashtag parents are watching initiative?
So we came together last month in Nashville, and we've been watching the FDA closely. They have been trying to expand EUA, the emergency use authorization, for COVID jabs in different populations. They had come out saying that the VRBPAC, which is the Vaccine-Related Biological Product Advisory Committee, was going to be holding a meeting to expand their EUA for boosters for 50-year-olds and above. Instead of waiting until that public meeting happened, which was scheduled for April 6th, they went ahead and gave that expansion prior to the public meeting. And now our concern is that they are going to switch the meeting and try to expand the EUA for 6-month-old to 4-year-olds, which they've been trying to do for several months now. So this is a major concern, and we decided that we had to take action immediately.
Oh, could you tell me some of the details, tell the audience some of the details about which clinical groups that we're talking about? Why in the world are they going after this young group? What is the clinical evidence that the vaccine might work? And what have they tried to take on to convince the public that the vaccine might be helpful at that young age?
So this is coming out from Pfizer. And Pfizer has been running clinical trials in this population, trying to prove vaccine efficacy so that they could give EUA to these kids. I mean, we know that they want to vaccinate every single American. They want to vaccinate every single human on this planet. It doesn't matter if it's effective or not. It's that we need to get this done, according to Pfizer, according to Moderna, according to AstraZeneca. So they have been having these trials and trying to prove their vaccine efficacy, and it has failed, not once, but twice. They have failed in both clinical trials to prove that efficacy was sufficient enough to give this vaccine to this age population of 6-month-old to 4-year-olds. So currently they are holding a third trial in which they add a booster dose. So you have the 2-dose primary series and a booster to get efficacy up high enough to get that emergency use authorization from the FDA.
Thank you for that. So, Kevin, what's your reaction to these moves by the pharmaceutical companies that stand to profit to the tune of billions of dollars from COVID-19 vaccinations in this population?
Well, we're not surprised. I mean, over the last year, we've kind of prepared ourselves for this big battle to protect our children from these tyrannical madmen. And we knew this was going to happen. So I'm very, very excited about the fact that the country is waking up and unifying around protecting our children, because the whole goal from the beginning was to, you know, take advantage and manipulate people where they can, we can then turn over our children to this industry. And but look, there's a long history of this. I mean, like Susie said, I mean, this is not something that, you know, just happened. This was always about going after our children. And I'm just excited about the fact that people now are more aware of it, not just a small group, not just this group that were fighting against it for many, many years, which I'm so proud to be a part of that. But I think what Susie outlined is something we should all be alarmed about, and we should be standing up against it, not just writing letters, but really standing in the public square and saying, you will hands off of our children. And I think that in the next couple of weeks, we have one, this is like part of the overall battle that we're going to be going through for the next decade. They will never stop. They will always try to figure out a way to commoditize our children's bodies for their bottom line. And I think that all of us together and doing this show with you, Jack, gives us the ability to inform more people about what their devious plans are. And I think in the next couple of weeks, you're going to see more people unified behind this. People that we didn't even know. We've got a lot of people now joining the ranks of medical freedom and talking about protecting our children and talking about all the damage that's been done to our kids that have taken the experimental biologic. We need to really show that as an example so other parents and other communities and government officials that might not have been with us in the past now see the long-term damage.
Okay, so let's talk about the different types of people that are out there in the world who, you know, it's difficult to communicate to most of the American public some of the sophisticated things that Susan just outlined. Right. And you're very practiced at communicating very sophisticated ideas and through the heart, Kevin Jenkins.
Well, the question, Jack, for me is this. What kind of future do you really want for your children? Do you want a healthy life for your children, or do you want your children to actually end up being slaves to an industry that doesn't value human life? Never mind about, you know, our children, just human life, you know, in itself. So for me, when I'm talking to parents around the country, I'm asking that question. What kind of life do you want for your children? I mean, do you want a child that is viable and thriving and loving and is able to socialize and connect with the rest of the world and be the future of our country, be the future of our world? Or do you want kids that are going to be permanently sick, permanently distracted by the fact that, you know, an industry believes that they have control over their body, or a child that's going to be free enough to build a new world that we need to live in? And that's a pretty interesting question, because at the end of the day, I don't think any parent, after 300,000 miles in this country and talking to parents, I don't think parents want that for their child. I think we have more people advocating and supporting us and saying, listen, this, you know, Big Pharma and, you know, the FDA and, you know, NIH and the World Health Organization, they don't tell us what to do with our children. It's time for us to take back our parental rights, and it's time for us to take control over our communities and our children and our health. And I got to tell you, from the time I started on this journey with all of the mama bears that were educating me for the last 2.5 years, I see a seismic shift. I think there are more people listening to Susie and yourself, never mind me, because you guys have been out in this wilderness fighting this battle for a long period of time. I think now the world is waking up. And the whole message was, for me, is children first. Our children should be first. Our children should be allowed to breathe. Our children should be allowed to thrive. Our children should be allowed to be free to socialize and be able to live in a world that was offered to us. We should be offering that to them.
That's well, very well put. So this coalition put together, Parents Are Watching, as a grassroots campaign, absolutely created by parents and grandparents. And the number one concern, as I understand it, is to make sure that FDA does not grant emergency use authorization to Pfizer's COVID shots for children under 5. I'm told that the shots are already purchased and clinics are ready to go. This is their MO, isn't it? Where they actually preload, pre-ship, they're doing it at what's called at risk. So the justification is, hey, they don't leave us hanging over a barrel here financially. And the regulatory authorities are primed to treat the authorization as a fait accompli or a foregone conclusion. So what I want to do next is I want to share the audio of the video. If you'll find a hashtag parents are watching. Now, listen to this, folks. These are parents and grandparents having their say today.
The FDA wants to fast track the Pfizer COVID shot for children under 5. What's the rush?
They say it's safe and effective. How do we know?
What if they're wrong?
Over 1 million injuries?
2 failed clinical trials.
9 pages of adverse events.
Who is accountable?
What about myocarditis in children?
Can my brain baby's heart be injured?
How is this affecting my baby's brain?
Can you be sure this won't cause future infertility?
Is this going to affect our children's mental health?
Will the science change again?
My healthy baby does not need these shots.
When it's your child, it's not rare.
Where is the science? Where's the data?
It doesn't stop infection. It doesn't stop transmission.
I want to see long-term safety studies.
Didn't Pfizer pay the largest healthcare fraud settlement in history?
It's time to follow the science.
Emergency use authorization is not approval.
We make the decisions for our kids.
Parents deserve a seat at the table.
Protect the children.
We're here to put you on notice that you will not get away with this.
Moms are watching.
This mom is watching.
This mom is watching.
Fathers are watching.
This dad is watching.
This dad is watching.
This grandmother is watching.
This grandfather is watching.
This attorney is watching.
This lawyer is watching.
Mental health professionals are watching.
Scientists are watching.
Doctors are watching.
Parents 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 are watching.
Millions are watching.
We are watching.
We are watching.
We are watching. And more importantly, God is watching.
So the missive is to tell the FDA to say no. Text the word FDA to 33777. Text the letters FDA to 33777. And get more information and follow hashtag everything hashtag on hashtag parents are watching on social media. Susie, when I watch that video, I see a lot of friends of mine in that video, and I know a lot of those people are suffering through the loss or injury of a child. And in the last 5 minutes that we have here, I'd like you to make the case that everyone within the sound of my voice needs to tell the FDA that they're not going to get away with this. Go for it.
It's not just that the FDA isn't going to get away with this. We have to start taking personal responsibility. Whether the FDA approves this or not is not the end all. It is parents. We have to stand up and fight back and protect our children. We have to say no. I know that it's difficult when your kids are going to school. It's hard to homeschool. It's hard to move states. It's hard. You know, there's plenty of blocks that we can say it's too hard. But you do not know the irreparable harm this could cause to your child. And I can speak personally as a mother that's been injured, that has a child that's been injured by vaccines, that suffering is not worth the risk. My child wakes up day after day after day, not being able to speak and communicate and live the life he was supposed to. It is not worth the risk. It is a shot in the dark. And there is zero reason to educate this population, to vaccinate this population. Absolutely none. And I'm sorry if I trip over my words in this, but that is how passionate I am about it. It is emotionally charged because I travel this country and I see kids from state to state that are injured by these vaccines, and no one is being held liable. The parents have nowhere to turn to. There are no resources. There are no doctors out there helping in the mainstream. We have to go seek out doctors that aren't able to take insurance, that are in these alternative communities that are being targeted by the medical industry, because we want to fight for our kids to help them get their bodies and their brains back. But this was unnecessary harm. Do not do this to your children.
That's pretty compelling. And sadly, as you know, I can tell you that science backs everything that you just said. And it was a long journey for me and a lot of information to process through the scientific literature to find what I found in linking the ingredients in vaccines and repeated activation of microglia in the brain. But this shot's different. This shot's a lot different. This biologic, this injection, it hits differently in the human body. So Kevin, what about the populations that might not be able to get this video or this audio, sorry, get this show? How do we reach them?
Well, we just have to keep talking to people. We have to keep doing what Susie said, traveling the country, you know, being the best evangelist, you know, for medical freedom and talking to parents that might not be aware. It's really interesting. You know, a lot of people say a lot of people don't know what's going on. I don't know if that's the case anymore. I think they've been very quiet. They've been doing their own research. They've been asking a lot of questions. They've been talking to a lot of people. There are more parents now aware of what's going on. But then let me tell you what I think is really going on. They're now starting to look at their kids and say, wait a minute, maybe I should have paid more attention to the vaccine schedule. Maybe I should have asked more questions. Maybe, you know, I should be more active in the space that Susie and all of the other parents around the country have been active in. And I think COVID, in some weird, crazy, unique way, has opened up the floodgates for parents to start asking a lot of questions about what do I do to protect my child's health? What do I do to help my child become a healthy human being? How do I get my community to invest in health as opposed to investing in fear and investing what Big Pharma tells us to do? And I got to tell you, I'm very, you know, if you'd asked me that question 2 years ago, I'd have probably been hair on fire. But I think parents now are now unifying, you know, with the patriots around the country, now with the medical freedom movement around the country. People are starting to stand up and they know that this is all about their children, all about their future, all about this country, all about the survival of not just themselves, but the whole nation, all of humanity, and all of the people that we believe need our support. I got to tell you, I'm really optimistic now about the fact that people understand what the role of the FDA is and what the role of NIH is and all of these other captured agencies. And even some of our government agencies, maybe 85% of our captured. I think people now know that they are. Now, that's a great start.
It truly is, Kevin Jenkins. Thank you so much for that. And, you know, people, what we've been talking about is despite the lack of data and two failed clinical trials, Pfizer keeps pushing the FDA to grant an emergency use authorization For children 6 months or 4 years of age, there are no data that suggests that this can help that population. And there's plenty of data that has been denied, including the mounting evidence of vaccine adverse events.
And Jack, can I just jump in on one thing there that you just said?
Go right ahead.
You said that Pfizer has been pushing the FDA to get this EUA, but in fact, the last time that Pfizer went to the FDA was because the FDA took unprecedented action and they went to Pfizer and asked them to apply for EUA. So we really need to be aware of what's going on within the drug and our regulatory agencies, because there is so much collusion and corruption, and the American people are not aware of that. And that is what I feel like we really need to highlight in this show today.
Well, thank you. I agree. I'm taking my talking notes from the video here that, the revolving door through regulatory cycles and regulatory capture is something that we fight against here too all the time. But, you know, the message is, since babies and young children don't have a voice, it's up to the parents to protect them. So please text the word FDA to 33777. FDA to 33777 and follow # Parents Are Watching. Thank you very both, my beloved friends, for being part of this experience today.
Thank you, Jack.
Thank you, Jack. Thank you.
You've been in that situation. The person next to you is sniffling, or worse yet, coughing. Flu, cold, and coronaviruses are everywhere. Wouldn't it be great if you had a way to reduce these threats with an invisible mask as an additional layer of protection? Sold by hundreds of pharmacists and medical doctors, our American-made povidone iodine antiviral nasal spray, Cofix RX, lasts for hours deactivating viruses and germs while protecting you from airborne pathogens that make us sick. America Out Loud listeners get 20% off. Use Cofix RX while in large groups, while traveling, or for any other type of high-risk situation as an additional layer of protection to help reduce your likelihood of catching a cold, the flu, or SARS-CoV-2 viruses. Right now, America Out Loud listeners get 20% off of all orders. Click our banner ad on AmericaOutLoud.com and use code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
People often ask me, Malcolm, how do we fight the corruption? Robert Frost has said it best. Freedom lies in being bold. Well, for six incredible years, bold is America Out Loud. Welcome to the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio.
My next guest has a lifetime of contributions in the area of medical ethics and informed consent. I would like to introduce Dr. Alvin Moss. He's professor and director of the Center for Health Ethics and Law at West Virginia University. Today, we're going to be talking about medical ethics and informed consent, focusing on principles of biomedical ethics. Welcome, Dr. Moss.
Good morning.
Good morning. So could you please just tell us a little bit about the history of your involvement in medical ethics and the general issue of ethics and conflicts of interest? That's how I came to know about you, as I consider you a major contributor to the establishment of healthy policies on conflicts of interest in major medical centers.
Sure. So actually, I'm a nephrologist, a physician who takes care of patients with kidney disease. And back in the 1980s, many of the dialysis organizations were for profit. And as a young nephrologist, I became concerned about the fact that there were studies showing that for-profit dialysis organizations seemed to be providing worse care than not-for-profit. And that got me interested. So I was just minding my business being a nephrologist when some of the ethical issues in the practice of medicine hit me right between the eyes. And so I actually did a fellowship in clinical medical ethics in 1989 at the University of Chicago. But even before that, my interest in ethics led the people at my health sciences center in University Hospital. So I was appointed the chairman of the hospital ethics committee in 1985. So ours was probably you know, 10% of the hospitals at the time maybe had an active hospital ethics committee, and ours was one of them. So in a sense, I helped become a leader there. And then because of my interest in ethics, I started our statewide ethics committee network in 1988. And ours is one of the longest lasting statewide ethics committee networks in the country. And actually, I'm preparing for our 34th annual symposium of our ethics committee network. So I've been at this for a long time, and my research interests have been really dialysis ethics. And I branched out from there because of some of the conflicts of interest. And you and I were discussing earlier that after the Association of American Medical Colleges in 2008 said that all medical schools had to have a policy on conflict of interest, our chancellor of our health sciences center asked me to head a committee to draft one for the health sciences center at West Virginia University. And so I did that, and it was used continuously for at least a decade or so. So I was involved early on, as you can see, and have sort of followed the practice of medicine and how it's evolved and where we need to be, or where I think we should be, and where we are not at this point. So
excellent.
That's sort of an introduction. Yeah.
Like I said, I think you're a major player in carrying that flame of the core of ethics around medical practice as well as medical research. So what I'd like to do is spend a little time discussing for the uninitiated some of the core principles and features of medical ethics in the short period of time that we have to give them a feel of flavor and understanding of how things should be, and then contrast those to how they could be, as well as then talk about informed consent and those principles along the way.
Sure. So medical ethics is really about deciding what's the right and good thing to do. The practitioner might ask him or herself, what should I do or what ought I do? And often it comes up, since patients often get sick and can't make decisions for themselves. Another related ethical question is, who should be making decisions for the patient who is unable to make decisions, let's say for herself? So those are two of the biggest questions that we face in patient care, but they become more complicated because there are conflicts. We talk about ethical dilemmas, and ethical dilemmas arise because of conflicts. The patient had said he never wanted to be on a breathing machine. And the patient now is sick and unable to speak for himself. And the wife says, put him on a breathing machine. And we say, whoa, wait a second. The principle of respect for patient autonomy says we should honor his wishes, not the wife's wishes. And so we are constantly dealing with conflicts. Or the patient may say, I don't want to go on dialysis. But the nephrologist will say, if you don't go on dialysis, you'll die. You must go on dialysis. And early on, and in fact, it's still very much the case, recent literature in the last year or two, patients with advanced chronic kidney disease face immense pressure to start dialysis. And we talk about powerful defaults in medicine, and there are powerful defaults. So even though patients should have a choice, they don't, or they don't feel like they have a choice. They feel like they really had to do what the physician said. And so this basic principles of medical ethics, there's lots of ways you can do it, but that textbook that you cited before, The Principles of Biomedical Ethics, it's probably in about its eighth or ninth edition now, from Tom Beecham and James Childress, who at the time were at Georgetown University, Kennedy Institute of Ethics. That has they talk about the Georgetown mantra of ethical principles, respect for patient autonomy, really allowing the patient to make decisions for herself or himself, beneficence, doing what's best for the patient, and of course, according to the patient's wishes, not according to the doctor's wishes. We would call that paternalism. Doing no harm. Everybody's heard be a benefit and do no harm is sort of shorthand for the Hippocratic Oath. And then justice, treating patients fairly, giving them what they deserve. There's been a real move for justice in this country, because unlike most industrialized nations in the world, we do not have national health insurance. And so people have to have the ability to pay, at least in some circumstances, to receive health care, very expensive health care. And so people have been very concerned about justice and how we can improve our healthcare system so that someone who needs a life-saving treatment shouldn't be denied it simply or solely because they're unable to pay for it. And of course, we have Medicare and Medicaid that are attempts to try and provide healthcare to larger and larger segments of the population. So that's sort of my brief discussion of medical ethics. Now, there are lots of other ways to do it, though. So the four principles have been referred, people who sort of characterize them as principalism, right? And the problem with principalism is it doesn't help you resolve conflicts. So there are other approaches to doing ethics. There's something called casuistry, where you look at a case, a paradigmatic case. Maybe it's the case of Karen Ann Quinlan or Nancy Cruzan or one of these famous cases. And you say, what did we learn from that case? And what principles or lessons can we apply to the case that we have at hand? So that's another approach. Then there's virtue ethics. What would the good physician do, right? And of course, then you have to talk about virtues and what do we think it means to be a virtuous physician? Things like promise keeping and truth telling and maintaining confidentiality and being competent, right? You don't want a physician who maybe is very good with bedside manner, but really is not very competent in their knowledge and skills in the practice of medicine, right? And then there's feminist ethics. More recently, there's been, proposed by some feminists that we really need to look at the patient in his or her whole network of care. And that we really are not isolated individuals, but we're within a network of relationships. And really, how decisions should be made should be based on that relationship to some extent. And then finally, I mentioned one other one, narrative ethics. Narrative ethics says, especially if we have a patient who is unable to make decisions at this point, if we look at previous chapters in their life, what would they tell us about what was important to the patient? What would she want? What would he want? What would he not want? So, as you might tell, there's no single agreed upon approach to doing ethics. And so we have this word eclectic. We use an eclectic approach where we basically sort of, take a little from this and a little from that. For example, the principles really work to describe the dilemmas. They're not nearly as good in resolving dilemmas. And so there we might lean on casuistry or we might lean on narrative to help us figure out what would be the right thing to do in this particular case.
Thank you for that overview on medical ethics with regard to medical practice. We're going to do other segments on other episodes on medical ethics when it comes to medical research. So we'll probably have you back for that. But what I want to do is I want to focus now with respect to medical care on the principles and practice and rules, really, of informed consent. And as I understand informed consent, the patient is expected to be able to make a decision on their own medical care if they are able to understand the benefits and risks of a particular medical procedure. However, isn't it also true that the attending physician and all physicians involved in decision making should truly understand the fundamental nature, of the benefits and risks of a proposed medical procedure?
Yeah, so really for the patient to give what I would call valid or true informed consent, they need to have information disclosed to them, and then they need to be able to understand the information. But if it's all right, let's take a step back. Why is informed consent considered so important in ethics and also in law? And legally, we talk about the patient's right to self-determination. And the legal system really considers it medical battery if a physician does something to the patient that the patient did not consent to. So why is it important? So if we go back to those principles of medical ethics that I just told you about, the first one is really the idea of respecting the individual autonomy of the patient. So to make sure that the patient is the one who's making the decision, we didn't always believe this way, but since about the 1970s, 1980s, we believe that it's the patient. If you recall, the whole patient's rights movement followed the civil rights movement of the 1960s. And so in the early 1970s, the American Hospital Association came out with the Patient's Bill of Rights. So we have rights and this right to make decisions for oneself, this legal right of self-determination, is the basis for the whole idea of the principle of informed consent. Okay, so we have to understand why it's important. And then once we understand why it's important, of course, informed consent protects patients, it protects research subjects, it promotes rational decisions. Really, there are lots of good reasons why we should want to have informed consent. And the model that's been used recently is this idea of shared decision-making. The physician is the expert in the diagnosis, the prognosis, and the treatment alternatives, but the patient is the expert in his or her own history, values, preferences, and goals. And the idea is they're supposed to come together and reach a decision about treatment according to the patient's values, not the physician's values. Remember, it's for the patient's benefit, not the physician's benefit. Yes, the physician might have huge medical school debt and might need to do a lot of procedures that reimburse the physician well, but that is a conflict of interest. If the physician is just recommending things that will clearly benefit him more than the patient, that is bad. Okay. And that's the reason why we require informed consent, why we have standards for informed consent. And as you said, you need to understand the information. You need to have been given the relevant information you need to know. You need to be given the opportunity to ask questions. You need to know what are the other options. I know you're recommending surgery, but is there a non-surgical approach, right? Is there medical management? And then the patient needs to be able to understand what are the risks and benefits of each of the different options, and then be able to use their own values to make a decision that's rational, that's logical, based on what's most important to them.
That seems perfectly clear to me. Is there a recent example that you know of where that seems to have gone askew?
Oh, yes, yes. So where we are right now is we have seen, so one of the seven elements of informed consent for it to really be legally valid is that it needs to be voluntary. There can be no coercion. And people have clearly written that mandates are coercive. Unless you do this, you're going to lose your job. You're going to lose your livelihood. So that really destroys the validity of the informed consent, but yet our country has gone along with that. And that is really a concern. And so people would say, well, public health ethics justifies compromising on true informed consent. But public health ethics also says one of its principles is you should use an approach that causes the least infringement on personal autonomy. But mandating that everybody stay at home for weeks on end, that you're only allowed to go outside once a day, and that's to take a walk or to get a shot, that, by the way, Pfizer or Moderna or Johnson & Johnson are making billions of dollars from. There seems to be a huge conflict of interest. And the fact that the CDC receives millions of dollars a year from pharmaceutical companies, and that there's not an adequate firewall between, you know, the money coming in and the decisions that are made at the CDC, and nor an adequate firewall at the FDA, who is doing emergency use authorizations when they really don't even know long-term safety. You know, they cut off and gave the EUA after 2 months of data, and then they purported to license the Pfizer vaccine. It's still not clear to me, since that vaccine's not available. But at any rate, with 6 months of data, and then they vaccinated 90% of the people in the control group to make sure we'll never have long-term safety data. This really, really, I would say, guts informed consent with regard to vaccines.
Okay, so the last point that I'd like to have you comment on is the culture and practice of what's normal now. We would expect that there are ethics reviews and consultations with experts in biomedical ethics when there are conflicts that come up on decisions that are being made by the patient about their healthcare. Could you talk about that as you have about 2 minutes to go ahead and tell us what's going on with that, please?
Sure. And let me say, because I forgot to say it earlier, my opinions are my own and not those of my employer. Since you did such a nice introduction, I want to make sure and say that. So, even if let's go to the medical literature for a minute, peer review of articles. What we read, we want to make sure. I mean, if you're getting informed consent, you want to make sure that you really have balanced information that you're presenting. And there's been a real concern that the medical journals are so influenced now by pharmaceutical companies that even editors of the New England Journal of Medicine and the British Medical Journal and Lancet, JAMA have all, and JAMA Internal Medicine have all written about how conflicts of interest have resulted in a decrease in quality of the science.
I don't want to interrupt, but I want to say with COVID, they threw away peer review and based policy on preprints that are not peer reviewed.
Yes, that's absolutely right. So, I mean, your point is well taken. So we really have to be concerned about the quality of informed consent. We have to be concerned about bias in the information that we're being given because of conflicts of interest. So we in the remaining time, we don't have time to get into all the issues, but just for your audience or your listeners to know that there are huge medical ethical issues with regard to how the pandemic has been handled. And in fact, I'm in the process of writing an article right now on rethinking the ethics of COVID-19 lockdowns, because you've probably seen even just a couple of weeks ago that there was an article showing that alcohol-related deaths went up by 28% during the pandemic. And the average annual increase prior to that was 3% a year. So it went up 8 times greater than it had previously been. And I'm sure you're familiar with the suicides going up and the drug overdose deaths. And so people are starting to think, did the pandemic and the way it was handled cause more harm than good, which of course is right back to medical ethics.
People should look up my article on Plan B, where I propose to actually structure an alternative way of doing public health research and biomedical research writ large. So I just want to mention that Dr. Moss has been very generous with his time, and I want to point people to ipac-edu.org, where you can sign up for a summer course to be taught by myself and Bernadette Pager this summer on medical ethics and informed consent. And Dr. Moss has agreed to give us a guest lecture during that course. So thank you, Dr. Moss. Have a great day.
All right. Thank you. Bye.